This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 16th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 461. On this edition, British Columbia's premier declared a state of emergency after the Summerland wildfire exploded. But BC's biggest wildfire began in mid-July in the Cariboo, so why didn't David Eby declare an emergency sooner? My guest is Kelly Sinoski, the editor of the Clinton Lariat newspaper. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. On August 8th, Premier David Eby declared a state of emergency across British Columbia due to wildfires.
To everyone affected, you are not alone. British Columbians are with you. This new fire marks a significant shift in the overall fire situation in our province. Today, based on the advice of emergency officials, Minister Green has declared a provincial state of emergency.
Nearly 20,000 people across the province are on evacuation orders. Some say that David Eby was days, if not weeks, too late. Premier David Eby on Thursday, August 6th.
I would like to know if the province is considering to declare a state of emergency at this time.
We're advised that as of this moment that I'm speaking to you, that is not required. But we have some very challenging weeks coming up, I'm told, by the BC Wildfire Service. And so if it is required for us to be able to use certain authorities under a declaration of provincial emergency, we will do that.
Wildfires happen every summer across the province, mostly affecting residents of the interior of the province. And one of those people living in the interior is Kelly Sinoski, the publisher and editor of the Clinton Lariat. It's the newspaper in Clinton, a village halfway between Vancouver and Prince George. Full disclosure, Kelly and I go back many years. We were both classmates at Langara College Journalism in Vancouver, both graduated in the class of 1990. We could go on for hours and hours about that, but we'll leave that for another time. Now, Kelly, you live now in 108 Mile Ranch and commute to work in Clinton. What is the current situation as of today when we're recording this, August 12th, where you live and work?
Well, the situation right now is that they have downgraded some of the orders, but it's mostly for the 70-mile Loon Lake, Green Lake area, and the Clinton area still remains on evacuation order. However, the fire has continued to expand and grow, and it's now on the other side by Hat Creek and Pavilion. So there's still a lot of hot spots out there affecting these areas. They say that even though they've been downgraded to alert, they could at any time go back to an order depending on what happens with the winds and the lightning and the heat and whatnot out there.
Describe what happened when you heard the first wildfire was happening and what the local response was.
Well, we had the fire at 59 Creek wildfire. That was the one out Big Bar Lakeway. So it affected about 20 homes out there, where it destroyed like 20 homes on the south end of the lake. But then there's also the fire that was about 18 kilometers from Clinton at Pear Lake, which is really close to town. There's a lot of homes that head out on that road, on Kelly Lake Road, between Clinton and the lake. And that fire, people were a little bit, they were wondering what was going on with that fire, because they say that even though it had started, they weren't really attacking it that much. One lady said basically she was concerned that they didn't really, she was watching it every single day. The first day she saw one helicopter. The second day she saw two helicopters, and one of those was a night helicopter. And the third day she saw one more helicopter. That was it. And then by day four, it already started blowing up. So it just swept through, came all the way down, crossed Kelly Lake Road by the hydro station there, where it supplies a lot of electricity to all of BC, or much of BC, I should say. And it came across there. It took out a couple of homes. So people that had lived there for decades, their homes were gone. And then it kept going and it cut across. And basically what it did was it came across and it cut over onto this ridge, and it took out like a bunch of businesses on Highway 97 south of town. So it took out like a towing shop and a repair shop that had been there for ages. It took out this little tire shop that's owned by a young family. It took out the rodeo grounds, the Willow Springs Resort, which is a trailer park where a lot of people had lived. And then it kept going, and it basically swung through, and it went right between the school and the rodeo grounds, and it kept going, and it just missed the town. So the townspeople and our village firefighters and the BC Wildfire Service had to work all night long to try to save the village itself, the town itself.
And how many people have been displaced by this?
Well, it's about, I'd say there's probably around 600 people in the Clinton area, so the town and the outlying areas. There are a lot of people who stayed in town to fight for their properties. They just didn't expect that they would be able to come home to something if they didn't stay. And to their credit, they did save their properties, because a lot of those really needed their help to do it. They just didn't have the resources out there to save those properties. A lot of people have gone to Kamloops. Some are in Ashcroft and Cache Creek. Many are here in 100 Mile House. I've got 5 evacuees in my house right now with my parents and 3 cousins. So yeah, people are just making do with what they can right now. And they're getting a little antsy. It's been 3 weeks, so they're ready to go home.
What has been the response of local officials, local government officials, regional district? How have they handled the situation?
You know, I think they're doing a pretty good job. The TNRD was fantastic in trying to get livestock out. So if people needed to get their cattle out, even after they were evacuated, they helped organize people to go in and get their livestock and move them to stockyards in Kamloops or Merritt or wherever, Williams Lake, wherever they had space, and these little buddy farms, they called them. So they've been pretty good at getting the word out and letting people know what's been going on. The Village of Clinton has been giving regular updates through Voyant Alert or on Facebook social media. So I think generally they've been doing a pretty good job in letting people know what's happening. As far as that goes, yeah, they've been pretty good. But there's a lot of frustration out there among people who feel that the province hasn't really been providing as much information as they could, especially the premier. There's calls for a state of emergency for weeks before, you know, when all this was happening. And then we didn't get one until finally Summerland blew. So
What are the BC Wildfire Service, did they respond quickly? And what about their sustained effort, if there has been a sustained effort to work on the fires, to bring them under control?
Well, I feel like the guys on the ground are working really hard. There is, and I have to check on this, but there are some concerns out there that they feel that from the higher-ups kind of could have done a little bit more to save the region. There's a lot of concerned that the fires were let go, like they weren't dealt with as quickly as they could have been dealt with. I'm not sure about that, but and I'd have to do a little bit more research on that. But there are concerns out there that people feel that maybe that more could have been done to try to get a hold of that Pear Lake fire before it got away.
What about other provincial departments that people rely on for whatever their needs are?
Yeah, I think that's all going to have to shake out later on. I think that, like I said, there's some frustration with a lot of the people here in the Clinton area in terms of how the province has responded. Specifically, I'm not sure exactly how that's going to happen, what they're feeling right now, because a lot of people right now are just trying to keep their animals safe, keep themselves safe. But we'll see down the road what kind of supports they get in terms of trying to, you know, get their animals home and have the feed and everything else they need to keep them going.
How does 2026 compare with other years that might be of note?
2017 was a pretty bad year for Clinton. So we had a wildfire then as well, and the whole town was evacuated only because there had 2 fires that were surrounding the town. We had the Elephant Hill fire in the south and Gustafson Lake in the north. So I have asked people this, and a lot of, I mean, is it worse or better? I mean, I think it's just different. This fire is pretty hot and pretty sustained. I mean, it was going pretty fast. It just blew up. So until we see the losses, it's hard to really tell what's going to happen. But I think it's pretty bad out there for a lot of people. Right now, we're still waiting for the roads to get fixed, right? So the people can go back home to Clinton. I think the roads are pretty bad south of town. We've got power finally back on, but there's still issues out there. So And previously, when I grew up in Clinton, yeah, we had wildfires, but I don't remember them being like this.
Yeah, back in 2017, I was able to track down some of the people that lost everything, who told me their stories, and also told me about their frustrations. As you alluded to earlier, the lack of communication from government. There were several people who had some help from the BC Wildfire Service in setting up sprinklers on their property, for instance, but then the sprinklers were taken away mysteriously. So they had a lot of questions, and they asked some of those questions through the Freedom of Information process and didn't get answers quickly enough. And some of them just got answers in the form of an invoice and had to complain to Victoria to pry the documents away from the government so they could find out what happened.
and why it happened.
People are finding similar issues with that, Bob, that you mentioned. I talked to one fellow who said basically they would come and people did put sprinklers on their homes or their buildings or whatnot, but then they took them away and they put them on someone else's home or building. So they felt like they were sort of robbing Peter to, you know, save Mary kind of thing, right? So there have been concerns about some of the ranchers saying that this is what happened. They would put some sprinklers up, but then they're like, oh, we need those now, that equipment. We got to go somewhere else. We had a lady out at Big Bar Lake Way who felt like she didn't get any help at all. Like she was out there fighting this fire and nobody would come. She begged and pleaded and nobody would come and help her. And when they finally did put a sprinkler up to save her barn, they put it 100 yards away. It wasn't even close enough to stop the fire. And then when they were trying to save, what they had to decide which barns to save because they were low on water and they had the fires were there. They just kind of popped up and she was trying to save a barn. And she said just this wildfire official just showed up and said, oh, your other barn is burned. She didn't even know where the guy came from, she said. So it was kind of a weird situation for her. Like she felt like that she doesn't have an issue with him saving her neighbor's homes, but she felt like she was kind of left alone in the woods there to deal with her stuff herself. And then people showed up in the middle of the night to see if she was still alive, which she thought was kind of odd that like, why, you know, we wanted to make sure you're still okay. And she's like, well, it's like 1:30 in the morning. And where were you when I needed you for a ground crews, right? So there's a lot of frustration for those kinds of stories where people had to fight themselves to save their properties and to save their livelihoods. And they feel like they really, frankly, a lot of people said they felt abandoned. They felt abandoned by the province. They felt abandoned by everybody, that they were just left out there with not enough resources to help them fight these fires. So, and they did put it, they had a petition out to try to get a state of emergency and nothing happened. And we couldn't get any comment from the premier on that point either. So I don't know. It sounds like it's similar to what happened in 2017, but a lot of people were just saying we just felt like they wanted this town to burn.
Are there any stories of local tragedy and local bravery that come to mind that you'll be telling in the pages of the Lariat? Is there anything that you want to tell the audience about certain people who have lost so much and are now trying to rebuild, as well as people who have made a difference, who gone above and beyond the call of duty to help the others in the community through this terrible situation?
Well, I feel like we've got, you know, Clinton is a town that does help everybody else, right? They're a very small town with generations of families that have lived there for generations and know each other, and everybody helps each other, right? They would give you the shirts off their backs if they could. And I feel like when it first started, we had, you know, we had our local cafe, right? We had the little Stagecoach Cafe feeding the firefighters. They stayed up all night long working shifts to make sure that they had food for the firefighters because they wanted to come through. So, and in that case, the community came forward and provided food, right? We had the 100 mile food bank came and donated meat without even asking. They just said, here you go, feed these firefighters. And people from Kamloops and local people brought garden stuff from Desert Hills or produce so that you could feed the firefighters. So that's what Clinton is all about. I think also people helping each other, right? We've got a lot of locals there who are helping each other try to save properties and working all night long. And I just think if it wasn't for them, we'd have a lot more losses. Everybody is pretty much supportive of one another in a lot of respects, right? To try to save our town. But as far as, I mean, and you think about it, I talked to one lady, she was out there. She saw some spot fires in her back pasture. So she went out there with the tractor and started throwing buckets of water on it. And then the tractor blew a tire. So her husband went to get the tire fixed in 100 mile. And he got blocked because the road was closed because they decided to close the road at that point and evacuate everybody. So she just kept going, taking it on foot, like throwing water on this thing. But her neighbor managed to get this forestry crew just showed up and said, here's some equipment, and started helping her. But then they were pulled off because of the evacuation order, and she had to learn how to use this equipment and started putting out the fire herself. So I think people, it shows how resilient people in Clinton are and how strong they can be when they're looking out to protect themselves, because, you know, if you feel alone, sometimes you got to just do it yourself. I think it just shows the community pulling together, really.
Do you think that enough is being done on prevention in any way, prevention among whether it's communication or whether it's infrastructure or whether it's forest fire management?
I'm not really an expert on that, Bob, but I know that we do have a community forest in Clinton, and they did a prescribed burn earlier this year and invited the community out to sort of see what they were doing. Perhaps maybe we've had a lot of and I'm not an expert, so I'm not really the best person. Perhaps there's just too many fuels from further, you know, maybe clear cuts in the past, or maybe the forest fire from 2017. Maybe it should have been cleaned up a bit more. There's left too much fuel on the ground, and maybe it's just too dry. Maybe it's just this drought conditions. We have to find new ways to do things. I can't answer that question. I'm not an expert on, well, but I think there probably is a lot of fuel on the grounds, and it is pretty dry out there.
Are you seeing more people move into the interior from other parts of British Columbia, whether it be from Metro Vancouver, you know, for work or because of affordability, that it's much more affordable to live in the interior of BC, or for lifestyle, it is a wonderful place to live? And if there's more pressure on development, is the local government and regional district, are they doing enough to ensure that any development is done responsibly and is done with fire prevention and mitigation in mind?
Yeah, we've had a lot of people move into Clinton during COVID. They came for the lifestyle. They came to get away from the city. They've you know, bought or rented. And there hasn't been a lot of development to date, Bob, in this region. In fact, we've lost our mills, right? So I think right now people are moving here, but they're either working remotely. So the village is looking at developing some housing, and so is the First Nation, one of the local First Nations. But we haven't had a lot of development so far, and I think that's something that they're looking at in far, as far as the community plan goes. But we are getting a new municipal government in October. Perhaps it's the same people, perhaps it's new people, but maybe that's something that has to be looked at going forward for sure. But we haven't had a lot of development. Are people building here?
What does this mean for you being a publisher and editor of a small town newspaper monthly, but now having to pivot to social media because you're reporting on something which is changing on a daily and many cases an hourly basis?
Yeah, I haven't done you know what, honestly, I just use my Facebook page to sort of update what's going on out there. I haven't been doing a lot on social media myself. I just post some of the stuff that comes out from the village or from the TNRD just to give people an update from official sources. I haven't really posted much from locals because, you know, I want to try to just get the official sources out there. But I did put a paper out this month, which was kind of tough because nobody's there in town. And what I did was I tried to get some copies out to the evacuation centers in Kamloops, Ashcroft, and Cache Creek, and then I delivered in 100 Mall House so that people did have the paper. So hopefully they all got a copy, and if they couldn't get a copy, I sent out digital versions of it so that I could get the latest out there for them, as well as give them a little bit of you know, local stuff that wasn't fire related, so they felt like they had a bit of a relief.
When you talk about your decision to move to the interior, you know, you spent many years in Vancouver. You were with the Vancouver Sun, but devoting yourself to community journalism at its most basic in the interior of British Columbia in small towns.
Yeah, I came back during COVID. So it was 2020. We had bought a property up here a couple of years earlier, like in 2018, thinking that maybe it would be a great place to retire. My mom is up here, so it's kind of close by to see her. And then COVID hit and we thought, let's just go up there and see what we can do up there. So I worked for the local 100 Mile Free Press for a couple of years, and then this opportunity came up, so I thought I'd take it over. And yeah, I really enjoy it. It's kind of an eye-opener for me to report on, you know, the town where I grew up and really wanted to leave and get out of there. But now I really love it. And I like providing something for the people who also contribute to the paper. So it's not just mine, it's theirs. They feel like they're part of this paper, and it's, we have contributors from all the different community groups. It's quite nice to be able to give them something that they look forward to every month. And it's nice to have local journalism, right? You know, we have so much anger, or not anger, but so much distrust, or people that don't want to support mainstream media. But these guys are in Clinton are very supportive of the Lariat, and I'm grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. What is the history of the publication?
It started as a nonprofit through the village itself, and then it became, I wouldn't say it's a profitable newspaper, but someone took it over in 2016 and, you know, tried to make it a bit more profitable. And so it's been around probably, I'm going to say, I'm not exactly sure, maybe 20 years, maybe 20 years. I'm not sure. I'd have to check that number on that, how long it's been around. But it started out as a black and white product, so we have color in it. So it's usually between 16 and 24 pages. We had a 28 page paper in June, so it depends on how big, how many ads we get and or how many pictures and stuff we want to put in. But we do try to get a lot of local events in there if we can. People really value that, I think, and especially in Clinton, like they look forward to this paper. If I'm late, I hear about it. So it's nice to be able to get the information that we can. I mean, not a lot of stuff happens all the time, but even just putting in like the local Canada Day celebrations is enough for people, right? Or the rodeo or the Clinton Ball, or, you know, the May Ball rodeo is pretty big in Clinton. So people seeing their friends and their family, they really enjoy that. And we don't just deliver to Clinton, right? We deliver all the way in 100 Mile and the outlying areas of 100 Mile and all the way to Ashcroft. So we're trying to get more and more stories from across the region. So we make it a bit more of a regional paper as well. And we have subscribers that go there as far away as Alberta and the US and the Yukon, actually. So people are pretty interested in having the local paper and just reading what's happening with people they've known forever. It's a town that, where, you know, a lot of people are related. A lot of people have friends that have left. When this whole fire happened, I had, I don't know, three classmates reach out to me, you know, what's happening? Where is the ranch? Okay. How about my home? You know, where I grew up, is that all right? How is so-and-so? Did she get out? How about my parents? Like, I had a friend in Alberta whose parents are in Loon Lake, and he's like, I can't reach my folks. You know, if the phones are down, what's going on? So it's a very tightly knit community where even if you leave, people are still pretty close. Right. And we might not be talking every day, but when things like this happen, people pull together.
Anything else that I haven't asked that I should have asked? Anything that you'd like to add?
I don't know. I think that, you know what, I think that, as you say, community newspapers are really valuable. Maybe not even just getting the, I mean, it's one of those things where this paper will probably have to be a little bit more in depth and maybe look at what's going on out there in terms of the fires. But I think they're also important in just being like something that gives people something to look forward to in a town. It's their paper. They get to sort of help out with it, contribute to it. And I just think it's, when it's yours, there's a lot of, it's just a way to bring the community together.
Well, thanks again for joining me on the podcast. Kelly Sanofsky, publisher and editor of the Clinton Lariat in British Columbia.
Yes, thanks, Bob. I'm just hoping everybody can go home soon because they're all getting, their patience is wearing thin.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Bookmark thebreaker.news and thebreaker.ca. Follow on social media. We're on X, Threads, and Blue Sky. Follow the YouTube channel for The Breaker videos. And sign up for the free email newsletter, bobmackin.substack.com. Become a paid subscriber. Get early access to podcasts. Thanks again, and until next week.